Chapter 42. Belgrade. The guard outside the Ragusa Logistics high-rise called inside to alert everyone that Major Basha had arrived. The major rolled his Explorer down the ramp and into the 100-unit parking garage that stored Lazar Alexich's ever-growing classic car collection, including the Escalade, Stingray, Jaguar, and a gold-plate Humvee so ugly and useless it made Basha's head swim. The rest of the garage was echoic and empty, without even proper oil stains on the poured concrete floor. Basha buttoned his suit jacket and strode up to the guard at the elevator who called upstairs to have the lift sent down. He rode up to the penthouse alone, reminding himself not to pistol-whip the stupid young gangster wannabe with his insipid blonde highlights and his cocaine habit. Idiot, Alexich might be, but not so dumb that Basha had unfettered access to the kid's trucking company or his organized crime connections throughout Europe. The youth was still useful, and he knew it. The elevator car was still four floors from the penthouse when Basha began to hear the reverberant backbeat of hip-hop music. He stepped out of the elevator and faced the night shift sergeant, a soldier who'd been with Basha for 3 years and who had a good head on his shoulders.
"The boy?"
They spoke up to be heard over the rap music.
"Clubbing for a while, sir. Came back early. I think he's waiting up for you."
Basha checked his watch. It was just a bit past 1 a.m. He rolled his eyes. The sergeant nodded and smiled and strode into the living room. Lazar Alexich stood, playing a classic arcade pinball game and drinking Dom Perignon out of a big gulp glass with a clear plastic dome and a fat red straw. He wore an Oakland Raiders jersey and around his neck braided gold chains as thick as rattlesnakes. His back was to Basha, his attention thoroughly on the pinball game. Basha strode to the sound system and shut it off.
"Who the fuck?"
Alexich spun and realized who it was, cutting off his response in mid-snarl.
"Hey, Major."
Basha scanned the expansive room with its view of Old Town and the Slava and Danube rivers. Belgrade sparkled at night.
"We have several refugees at our base," he said. "You promised buyers for 6 girls and 4 boys.
Alexich took a long sip of champagne through the plastic straw.
Yeah, sure do. You said France is shut down?"
"It is," Basha said, without explaining why they could not sell any slaves via the French route.
"No problem, no problem. I have a broker in Krakow. He'll take them. Honestly, I have a buyer right here in Belgrade. He wants 2. We could move them today."
Basha said,
"2 of what?"
Alexich shrugged.
"I don't think he's all that picky."
Basha didn't want details about the perversions of the buyers. He just wanted to count their money. He nodded.
"So that's 12 total,"
the young man said, nodding quickly. His eyes were wildly dilated. Basha noticed that his hair now had coppery red highlights along with the blonde. That annoyed the major even more.
"And, let's make it lucky 13.
"You have a 13th buyer?" Basha was thinking. Lieutenant Akhil Krasnichi had reported that 19 youths had just been transferred up from the refugee camp in Macedonia. Depending on what happened with the St. Nicholas fools and the International Criminal Court, these 19 might be the last of the commodity for weeks or even months to come. Any of them that Alexich could sell, they ought to. Any he couldn't? Well, digging ditches is a time-honored make-work project for soldiers, and ditches aren't that different from graves. The youth wet his lips. He slurped more champagne, his cheeks caving. His eyes glanced toward the buttery leather couch and the low, glass-topped coffee table.
"I want one of them. The Muslims, for me."
Basha checked his watch. He had a plane to catch.
"Why?"
Alexich hesitated.
"What is it?"
The kid wiped his sweaty palms on the sides of his too long Raiders jersey.
"I just want one, okay? I don't need to explain why. I've got the trucks and I've got the buyers, right? And we've got more of the little freaks than we do buyers. At least for now. We can afford for me to use one."
Basha shook his head.
"You're not happy fucking every tart in heels at the clubs. That's none of my business. If you don't want to fuck him,"
Lazar Alexich said. His eyes glanced toward the coffee table again. The table, under which one of his whores had bled to death. Basha began to see.
"You want a girl who no one will miss, right? Yes. Like her."
Alexich didn't know the name of the girl he'd picked up at Club Obsidian. He hadn't known then, and he hadn't known when Basha shoved an ice pick into her heart.
You know, the girl you...
Basha nodded.
I know.
Well? It was a tricky question. If Basha's unit was moving heroin, and if their distributor was using the product overly much, Basha would simply have him killed and move to a different distributor. But slave trafficking was a tougher, if more lucrative, prospect. The distributors weren't exactly falling from the trees, and it wasn't quite the same as dealing with a junkie to sell junk. That was inherently stupid. This was just risky. He said,
"How old?"
Alex had shrugged. Nerves made him stutter.
"I don't know. Doesn't matter. Older, I suppose. Yes, older."
Basha drew his mobile phone, the one with the security encryption built in. He placed a call to the officer of the day at KSF Operating Base Shar. Basha wasn't worried that it was 0130 hours. Soldiers work when the work is needed. A voice answered after three rings.
"Sir."
"Major Basha," he barked.
"Krasnichi?"
"Yes, sir, I have the watch."
The lieutenant tried not to sound like he was struggling awake.
"The 19, Basha said, not using specific, criminally actionable nouns despite the encryption software.
"Are they all of the same age?"
He could hear Krasnichi gulp water, trying to wake up.
"Yes, sir, more or less."
The younger they were, the higher the price they could demand among the most disturbed buyers.
"Are there any that are older?"
One, sir. A girl. Syrian, I think. She looks,
I don't know, 18 maybe, 19?
Basha said,
"Get three of them up here tonight. The older girl plus one boy and one girl. Bring the other 10 up tomorrow. Understood?"
"Sir."
"Good. Any problems there?"
Krasnichi said.
"None whatsoever, sir."
"Good. Out."
Basha hung up.
10 for your buyer in Poland, 2 for your buyer here, and, let's call it a sales bonus, shall we?"
Lazar Alexich grinned. He slurped champagne. Earlier in the day, he'd sent one of his posse, that was the American term, to nick a brand new ice pick from a restaurant supply store without explaining why he wanted it. He was ready. Chapter 43. Kosovo Security Force Operating Base, Shar. No more food was coming. Mohammed Bakur was sure of it. He decided the time had come to act. Jinan Huri had brought them this far. She didn't even know Mohammed's family, not really, and he knew for a fact that she'd had several opportunities to leave Mohammed and his little sister Amira. Nobody would have blamed her if she'd left after her friend, the photojournalist, died. She could have left them at the last checkpoint, too. But she hadn't. And now the wise and worldly Jinan, who was so different from any girl Mohammed had ever imagined back home, was as lost as they were. She had no idea where they were. She didn't know a way out. They were prisoners, along with 16 other refugees. These soldiers had no intention of getting them to the freedom of Europe. They were in enemy hands, as doomed as if they'd fallen into the clutches of President Assad's forces, or worse yet, Daesh. So it was time for Mohammed to act like the man he was. First, no more food was coming, that was clear. They'd given Amira half of the one tasteless sandwich they'd had for the three of them, all wilted lettuce and mystery meat. Jinan had given Mohammed the other half, but he insisted on eating only a quarter and shoved the rest back into Jinan's hands. The exotic English girl had looked so grateful. Mohammed had come to understand that he was madly in love with Jinan, even though she was ancient, at least 25. Didn't matter. She'd captured Mohammed's heart, and he'd do anything to show her that he was man enough to protect her and Amira. One of the other Syrian kids had a wristwatch with a plastic strap and numbers that glowed in the dark. Mohammed squinted at it and realized it was well after 1 in the morning. No more food was coming, but probably no more guards either, at least not until morning. Mohammed threw off the scratchy blanket and sat up. His wooden canvas cot groaned a little. Like the others, he slept in his clothes. He slipped on his Adidas sneakers and crept to the toilet room. He'd seen it before when he'd needed to go. It smelled of mildew and men. The grout between the tiles was black with grit or green with fungus. It was hard to tell in the low light. He'd spotted windows earlier, and now he stood on one of the lidless toilets to see if the nearest one would open. It wouldn't. From what Muhammad could tell, it hadn't been designed to open ever. He climbed down, listened for trouble, then checked two more windows. They were the same. He crept out of the bathroom and walked softly across the barracks room. At one of the windows, he glanced out and saw the glow of a cigarette from the guard outside the one and only door. The glow reflected off the barrel of a rifle slung over the guard's shoulder. Muhammad snuck into the cafeteria room next, walked between its rows of tables and benches. He spotted more of the small, square windows, the same as he'd seen in the toilet room. No hinges, no sliders, no hope. He crept farther into the room, into the dishwashing area with the large fridge, empty and unplugged. The stench of old milk wafted out when he checked. Would the guard outside smell it? The dead would smell that, Muhammad thought. He found a door that led outside, but with a padlock bigger than Muhammad's fist. He jostled one of three big plastic garbage cans with his hip. Something caught his eye. He shoved the can away from the wall. A square hatch had been cut into the wooden wall on the same side of the barracks building as the side door, facing barracks 2. The access hatch was more or less the same size as the thick gray plastic garbage bins. Fill them up, shove them outside to be collected by whoever, whenever. The hatch was a door on tracks above and below. It also had a small metal hasp, L-shaped, and another padlock. The hasp screwed into the wooden wall and was held in place by only one screw, although it had holes for two more. Muhammad touched the L-shaped bit of metal and jostled it a bit with the tip of his finger. He returned to the cupboards beyond the empty fridge and the big double sinks. He opened them one at a time. In the fourth drawer, he found an old can and bottle opener, the size of a stick of gum, both ends angled up, one end squared off, and the other pointed like an arrowhead. He'd seen his mother open bottles of Coke with the flat end and cans of soup with the arrowhead end. His father had taught him about Archimedes. "Give me a lever long enough and a fulcrum on which to place it, and I shall move the world." His father had called Archimedes a great Arabic thinker. A teacher at school said he was Greek, but Muhammad figured the teacher just got it mixed up. He took the opener back to the hatch in the wall. He gently shoved aside all three garbage bins. He knelt and fit the arrowhead end of the opener between the wooden lip of the wall and the metal hasp. He slowly, slowly applied pressure. The hasp strained against the single screw head. The screw began to move. Chapter 44. The team spotted two guards on roving duty. They walked in a pair clockwise, chatting softly. It took them about 35 minutes to make one loop of the perimeter. The team watched them make the loop twice. It was after 0200 hours when Fierro gave a signal. She and Brody McTavish moved downhill, creeping quickly. Finnegan watched them until Fierro seemed to disappear. Then he just watched McTavish. Since he'd met her, he'd known Fierro could move in such a way that she was difficult to track. He called it ghosting, or just to annoy her, that crazy ninja shit you do. McTavish got to the fence and found it neither electrified nor well lit. He carried bolt cutters in his rucksack and snipped open a vertical access point. Once they were done, Finnegan and the other three mercenaries scuttled downhill and crouched through into the grounds of Operating Base Shar. McTavish then used simple black twist ties to secure the sides of the fence again, using them almost like sutures. The vertical slit wouldn't be visible from a distance, but it could be reopened in a heartbeat. Fierro appeared out of nowhere, touched Finnegan's thigh, and pointed south. He nodded and followed the perimeter fence toward the motor pool garage. She tapped Lo Kuan and Ficado on their shoulders, pointed toward the exercise field and the 25-foot guard tower. The duo moved north and disappeared from sight after a dozen paces. Fierro, McTavish, and the laconic Italian, Bianchi, moved toward the heart of the base and the row of barracks. Lieutenant Akil Krasnici had hoped to get back to sleep after the major call from Belgrade. But now he needed to organize a night run north into Serbia. Krasnici had 19 of the grubby little Muslim beggars in Barracks 3. Major Basha wanted 13 of them transferred to Belgrade. Would they hold on to the last six or dump them in the forest? Krasnichi would follow his orders either way. For now, his plan was to move while the prisoners were asleep and groggy, rouse them, get them up and startled, and separate them fast. Move three tonight and let the rest go back to sleep. Wake them up before dawn. The lack of sustained sleep helped keep them off balance, and move 13 more north. He'd keep them calm by telling them the United Nations can only process so many refugees at a time, and that they'd be reunited by lunchtime. Krasnichi rolled out of bed, reaching for his fatigue jacket and his walkie-talkie. Chapter 45. Finnegan stole his first car at age 12. He remained proud of that to this day. In his Long Island neighborhood, the median age for a first Grand Theft Auto was 15, maybe 15 and a half. He'd gotten caught, of course, and his mother had screamed at him for a week. Detective Patrick Finnegan, upon hearing about it, waited until his wife was celebrating Mass, then took his son out to the garage to the Charger he'd been rebuilding and said, "Show me." The two of them laid out on the front seats of the Charger, and Michael showed his dad how to find the appropriate wires from within the steering column. "What the hell is this?" his dad had asked. "That's not the way you do it. Who showed you this?"
I can't tell you." His father had snorted something that might have been an appreciative laugh.
"Look at me. You looking at me?"
His son nodded.
"Never, ever, ever get caught stealing another car or anything. Just don't, okay?"
His son nodded.
"See this? This is the ignition wire. Now watch and learn."
The two guards on perimeter duty around KSF Operating Bay Shar strolled counterclockwise. Finnegan headed the same direction in their wake. The land around the fence included several rough drainage ditches and a couple of oil tanks, so the going and the sneaking were easy. But getting caught meant getting shot, so Finnegan took it slow. The base motor pool was a classic auto garage with one rolling bay door and room inside for maybe a dozen vehicles, including trucks. From the first window he came to, Finnegan spotted a lube oil filter pit for basic maintenance, partially occluded by a late-model Jeep. Maybe a quarter of the vehicles within were in some state of disassembly and repair. The rest were just parked. He circled the garage, checking every window. No light shone. He sketched the building's geometry in his head and determined that there were no hidden rooms within. He also caught no signs of any security wiring. Who steals a truck from inside a military base out in the middle of Kosovo's version of the ass end of nowhere? Nobody. And the security precautions reflected that theory. He spotted two doors and picked the one farthest from the well-lit admin building. He placed the Halligan bar against the door jamb, brace hand near the wood, pressure hand out at the far end of the handle, and applied the slightest pressure, then slightly more. He watched as the tongue of the lock slid free of the door jamb. Once it was out, the door swung open with no significant damage or noise. There was no way of knowing how many refugees they'd be driving out. Once inside, Finnegan moved toward the largest supply truck he could find, a massive diesel Scania with a detachable canvas top stretched over steel ribs. He drew his penlight and shone it across the truck's canvas side. He did the same for two more trucks. He glanced at an oil barrel standing upright between the tops. Something lay across the top, looking a bit like laminated placemats you might find in a diner. Finnegan moved closer and ran his light over them. They were magnetized rubber logos, the kind that can be adhered to the door of a truck, then easily peeled off. They bore the logo of Ragusa Logistics. Lo Kuan reached the wooden guard tower first. It stood 25 feet tall with four sturdy legs and a simple wooden box with a hip-high support wall and a roof over it, like every guard tower ever built at every army base on Earth. The mercenary preferred to work with his hands free, so he didn't bother carrying a rifle. He tested the lowest rung of the tower ladder and found it well constructed and sufficiently nailed. It made no noise as he applied weight to it. He glanced around again and saw no one close, although he thought he saw more lights on inside the admin building than he'd noticed before. Could be an illusion, he told himself. He glanced back over his shoulder. The sniper, Ficado, nodded. Clear. Lo began climbing. He tested every rung before trusting it. He worked slowly. Quick movements will catch a person's peripheral vision, especially at night, in ways that a slow and steady motion won't. He heard floorboards creak overhead. The guard in the tower, ambling slowly from side to side, partly to keep an eye on the base below, but partly to keep awake. Lo had done his fair share of late-night sentry duties, and he knew what every good soldier knows. General boredom and general fatigue undermine more campaigns than the finest strategists. He reached the point at which his head was almost level with the underside of the floorboards. He paused and listened. The highway, only a kilometer away, provided a regular swoosh of late-night traffic. An air conditioning system atop the admin building chugged. Crickets chirped in the fields around the base, and bats flitted in and out of the small forest to the east. He heard an outer door of the admin building swing open and slam shut on springs. He heard the low murmur of voices speaking a Slavic tongue. The guard in the tower moved in that direction to see what was going on. Lo Kuan took the last two rungs. He spotted the sentry, his back to him, wearing fatigues and lace-up boots. The sentry held his carbine rather than slinging it over his shoulder. Good on you, soldier, Lo thought. The man was average in size, with a buzz cut and a black beret cocked at a fuck-you angle. Lo stepped up and onto the platform, moved behind the sentry. He reached up and swept the man's beret forward, covering his mouth with it. He locked his other forearm around the man's throat, tight. He swung his legs around the man's hips, leaned, and tipped them both onto their backs. Lo's rucksack took the brunt of the fall. The sentry reached for the thing that was being pushed into his mouth. Naturally, that meant dropping his rifle, which, like all well-maintained carbines, did not discharge on impact. On their backs, Lo's legs locking up the sentry's legs, his arm crushing the man's carotid artery, jamming the black beret further into his mouth. The man struggled but had no leverage. He tried kicking at the hip-high retaining wall, but Lo minimized his leg movements. The brain focuses on suffocation before all else. The real threat was the pinched-off carotid, but the wool cap in the man's mouth and the panicky tightness when he tried to draw a breath kept the sentry's hands busy scrambling for his own face and not reaching back for Lo's eyes. It would have been much, much easier for a knife artist to kill the sentry, but Catalin Fierro and Michael Finnegan called the tune. All without or all within. Kill nobody if you can help it, but if the plan goes pear-shaped, kill whomever you come upon. They were still in the kill-nobody phase, but that could change swiftly. It took less than 60 seconds for the sentry to slump. Lo had done this enough to know. He waited to feel the man's thigh muscles under his own thigh muscles relax. That was the true sign that he was out and not faking. Lo Kuan rolled the man onto his stomach. He reached for the zip ties he carried on a pouch on his belt, secured the man's wrists behind his back and his ankles to his wrist. He kept the beret stuffed in the sentry's mouth but cleared his nose. He moved back to the ladder, digging a red-filtered penlight out of his rucksack, and flicked in on and off 3 times. He saw Fecado sprint from out of a drainage ditch and jump onto the ladder, his sniper rifle bobbing on his shoulder. Chapter 46. Fierro heard the telltale chirp of activation from her earjack.
"Striker has eyes,"
Fecado, the sniper, announcing that he'd taken up position atop the guard tower. Fierro tapped her earjack. Everyone would hear the confirmation chirp. No need to comment further. Fierro, McTavish, and Bianchi were hunkered down next to Barracks 4, which appeared to be empty. A cluster of old oil barrels had been left to the side of the barrack and made for a good duck blind. The big Scotsman made a gesture in the direction of the admin building. They'd all heard the door opening and swinging shut, and the sound of men talking, but too far away for Bianchi to interpret. The Italian tensed up, and Fierro made a no-go gesture. He settled back down. The plan still relied on stealth. The Kosovars were committing major international crimes from this base. If the team could steal a truck, get the kids on board, and hit the gate, the guards, like all military base guards, would be on the lookout for someone breaking in. They could get to the highway in under a minute, and the troops involved in human trafficking likely would hesitate before getting into a running gun battle on an international highway. That was Plan A. The chatter continued. The bad news: more soldiers were awake and moving about than they'd hoped for. The good news? The chatter sounded casual. The soldiers weren't awake and moving about because of St. Nicholas and the Mercs. Something thumped behind the barracks. McTavish and Bianchi, both down on one knee, twisted in that direction. The Italian rose and crept to the southeast corner of Barracks 4, farther from the light and chatter, close to the forest-side perimeter fence. Fierro covered her mouth with her palm, pushing her voice wand closer to her lips.
Stryker, eyes on the men by admin?
Picado replied softly.
Affirm. How many?
Three.
She heard another soft thump from somewhere behind the barracks. Were they being distracted by soldiers talking loud at the well-lit admin building while someone moved up on their flank? Bianchi, at the right rear corner of the building, brought his automatic rifle up to his shoulder, elbow on his knee, eyes on the raised rear sight.
Hold fire,
Fierro whispered for the sake of everyone, but mostly for the Italian. Bianchi shot her a look. She stared him down. He put his good eye back on his rifle sight. Mohammed let the garbage hatch thump shut, wincing at the noise, and duckwalled from Barracks 3 to a high chain-link fence, beyond which lay a forest. He knelt, further ripping out the knees of the only jeans that still remained from the beginning of the family's odyssey. For the first time in his 15 years, he smelled moldering pine needles and rich brown earth and the sweet decay of dead birds and squirrels. The potpourri of it made him dizzy. The forest was loud, too. Why had no one ever told him that forests were loud with frogs and cicadas and owls? He took a moment to take in the darkened base. It seemed huge to him, with lights atop tall poles and wooden buildings with metal roofs. The road through the camp, what he could see of it, was well-paved and smooth. Mohammed had seen well-paved roads only on important government streets, and he subconsciously associated fresh tarmac with power. He wondered what country he was in that had such wealth that they could pave the roads in the army base. He had no doubt they were prisoners. The military types of Syria had been hardened and bitter, but didn't care about the refugees. The military types of Turkey and Greece had been overwhelmed and stunningly disorganized, even from the perspective of a 15-year-old, and hadn't particularly cared about the individual refugees, seeing them only as a river of people that needed to keep flowing in order to save themselves from drowning in it. But the soldiers of this unnamed country cared about the refugees, and, Mohammed realized with terror, they seemed to care for all the worst reasons. He had excellent night vision and watched as three men slipped out of the two-story wooden building, about mid-center of the camp, talking and lighting up cigarettes. A fourth soldier joined them, but quickly jogged away. He was gobbled up by the night, only to emerge in the cone of light under one of the poles 20 yards down. Mohammed didn't want Amira to wake up and find him gone, or the exotic English adventurer Jinan, for that matter. He rose in turn, but quickly fell to his knees among the reeds. A man appeared at the next low building to Mohammed's left. The man knelt at the corner, one elbow on his raised knee, and aimed a rifle down the length of the rear side of the barracks buildings. The path to the garbage hatch in Barracks 3 and Mohammed's way back to his sister intersected perfectly with the sights of that ominously long gun. Finnegan got the housing off the steering column of the great Scania truck and separated the wires by color, using a penlight held in his teeth for illumination. His ear jack chirped. The languid, almost musical voice of the Ethiopian shooter, Fakado, whispered to him,
"Keeper has a Bravo heading his way."
Finnegan twisted the penlight to shine on the webbing between his thumb and fingers. Bravos were the bad guys, that one he knew.
"Keeper, that's me, right?"
He heard gravel crunch. He lay sideways on the elevated driver's seat, his legs dangling horizontally in midair, and slid out of the truck, quietly closed the door. With a rumble, the big garage door began to rise, a narrow rectangle of dim light emerging on the cement in growing oblong. Finnegan dashed across the garage toward an older model Jeep. He saw a pair of legs and boots outside the rising door. He slid to one hip like a runner stealing second, gliding under the Jeep, landing inside the lube, oil, filter pit. Chapter 47. Lieutenant Akhil Krasnichi smoked down one cigarette and waited for the private to retrieve one of the trucks. Each of the Ragusa logistics vehicles had the necessary bumper stickers to get through the borders of Schengen Agreement countries without stopping to be searched. He shook a cigarette free of the carton and handed it to Corporal Aegon Yumnica, who accepted it and a light.
"The Major wants three of the cattle heading north tonight. The oldest girl we've got and two others, boy and a girl," the lieutenant said. "I'll take them." Yes, sir. Yumnika drew on his cigarette. You're the duty officer soon as I leave.
Yumnika straightened up. Yes, sir.
They heard a revving engine from the direction of the motor pool. Yumnika and the private with them finished their smokes, and Lieutenant Krasnichi led them toward the barracks. The truck would meet them there. The man guarding the barracks snapped to attention as they approached. The lieutenant made a gesture with his chin, and the guard shouldered his rifle, digging keys out of his fatigued jacket. Krasnichi led his two men inside, leaving the guard where he was. The private hit the lights, and refugee children began stirring on their cots. As they sat up, rubbing sleep from their eyes, Krasnichi looked at them.
Her,
he gestured toward a girl who was maybe 20 or maybe a little older.
And two others, one each, don't care who.
The private spoke fluent Arabic, but with a Riyadh accent. He stepped forward and spoke slowly, keeping his orders rudimentary.
Attention, please. The United Nations checkpoint is overrun with refugees. They need to start getting people through as quickly as possible. We need to take three of you now. Everyone will be reunited at a British camp over the border.
Jane Hoori was still half asleep. The ringing in her ear had faded, but her head still ached. Three soldiers entered the barracks, threw on the lights, and were talking, but their accents were weird and she was having trouble following. Something about a British camp over the border? There were no British camps anywhere near the Balkans, Jane knew. She must have misheard. The soldier who spoke pointed to her and made a get-up gesture. Maybe he'd figured out she was English? She tried standing and felt her gorge rise. You're concussed, you daft cow, she chided herself. The room spun. Amira was standing too, so Jane put an arm around the girl's shoulder. Another refugee boy, one of the Afghans, stepped forward after towing on his ragged Chuck Taylor trainers. The soldiers moved to escort them toward the door. Amira pulled back. She grabbed Jane's hand and yelled, which set off the spinning in the room and the dental drill headache over her right eye. Amira said something. What?
Muhammad!
One of the guards scooped Amira as if she were a rolled-up sleeping bag and made for the door. Another grabbed Jane by the upper arm.
No, wait! She tried to clear her head. Wait, we...
The guard shoved her toward the door.
No, I can't. Muhammad, he's...
The guard cuffed her on the back of her head. Jane went to one knee and dry-heaved. Amira screamed as the soldier carried her under one arm out the door. Jane was lifted to her feet and escorted roughly.
Wait, we're with a boy,
the soldier who spoke Arabic said.
I understand. You'll be reunited. It's okay.
A small truck pulled up in front of the barracks. The Afghan boy and Amira were ushered, none too gently, into the back.
No, wait. Muhammad, I have...
The guards put hands under Jane's armpits and hefted her easily into the back of the truck. Amira screamed. The soldier raised the tailgate of the truck, then whacked the brace twice with an open hand. The driver put the truck in gear. Chapter 48. Fierro hissed,
"We hold."
A small truck with the logo of Ragusa Logistics had pulled up in front of Barracks 3. Soldiers had entered the building and now emerged with three of the children, two girls and a boy, all dusty and disheveled. The younger girl, with her arm in a cast, howled in fear. They were hustled into the small truck, and two soldiers joined them. A third soldier and the original guard remained. Fierro peered into the night and recognized the soldier. It was their old pal, Yumnika, the same guy they'd captured in the Loire Valley in France. The truck spat gravel, heading back onto the main road. Egon Yumnika held a walkie-talkie to his lips and spoke in Serbian or Armenian. Fierro couldn't tell the difference. Didn't matter. He was calling ahead to the gate to alert them that the truck was heading their way. Fierro grinned wolfishly. She touched her ear jack.
Keeper, good to go?
Finnegan said.
Give me 60. Change of plan, we're taking the bastards now. Striker, subdue the base, please.
Vicado said.
Confirmed.
Midfielder, deaf and blind, please.
Loquan spoke from elsewhere in the base.
Confirmed.
Fierro made a come-here gesture to the men behind the oil drums. McTavish moved forward quick-like. Bianchi did not. McTavish started to repeat the gesture, but Fierro stopped him. Her message was clear. Either the Italian followed orders or he didn't, but he didn't get to pick whose orders he followed. After a beat, the Italian dropped his rifle to his side and squat-walked to join them. Fierro covered her voice wand, speaking only to the two of them.
Corporal with walkie, we need him. Guy at the door is expendable. McTavish has him.
Bianchi hissed.
I thought I saw someone back, she said. Try not to piss yourself. Let's go.
She swung her carbine over her shoulder, the strap crossbody, and drew her sig. She stepped around the corner of the barracks and advanced, the guys behind her. They were now only 5 paces from the soldiers, who were chatting with each other. The guard laughed. Corporal Aegon Yumnica spotted Fiero, and his brain took a moment to realize who he was seeing, here at his nice and safe base. She stepped past the guard and jammed her sig into Yumnica's face, barely 2 inches from his nose. She heard McTavish deck the guard a pace behind her. The man's head ricocheted off the barracks wall, and he bounced into McTavish's arms, as limp as a rag doll. Fiero had been watching the keys in the guard's hand. They hadn't gotten around to relocking the barracks. She used her free hand to reopen the door. Corporal Yumnica started to speak, and she used the gun to bop him on the bridge of his nose. Not hard, just enough to shut him up. She grabbed his lapel and shoved him into the barracks. Then, following as he stumbled inside, Fiero drove the sole of her boot into the side of his knee. Yumnica crumpled. McTavish hauled the unconscious guard in her wake and dumped him on the floor. Bianchi scooped up the man's fallen rifle and entered, closing the door behind them. Fiero went to her haunches and took Yumnica's gun and walkie-talkie. The refugee kids were awake, most of them sitting on cots or standing next to them, eyes wide.
"Be calm," Fiero spoke Arabic. "We're not here to harm you. Please stay calm."
A girl with a patch over one eye, who was all of 14, said,
"Who are you?"
Fiero offered the girl a warm smile, aware that she wore all black fatigues and carried firearms.
"We're here to get you out. Tell everyone else, would you please?"
She turned to Aegon Yumnica.
"Hi. Remember me?"
"How the fuck did—"
She clocked him in the ear with the side of her gun, just enough to get his attention.
"I'd like nothing more than to shoot your cock off, Corporal. Do as I say and you'll rob me of that joy, you understand?"
He nodded, eyes wide.
"Good. We're stealing your refugees. Why should your corrupt major make all the profit? Our commander wants a slice of this sweet pie, too. Money enough to go around, yes?"
It had been Finnegan's idea to play the role of the competitor, appear to be an invading force, and the soldiers of Operating Bashar might suffer from an onset of late-stage patriotism. Appear to be criminals ripping them off, and they'd be less likely to risk their own hides in an all-out battle. The corporal glared at her.
"Fucking bitch. The whole thing in France, that's right. We needed the Serbian kids' buyers. Now we're—"
Something rattled in the mess hall, like a pan on a cabinet. A shadow flitted across the double doors. Bianchi raised his silenced carbine. McTavish reached him first, a hand the size of a catcher's mitt, shoving the gun an inch to the left. Bianchi fired, the sound suppressor huffed. The bullet blew a hole as big as a bagel through one of the dining hall doors, 6 inches from the head of Mohammed Bakur. Chapter 49. The guy who jogged into the motor pool and grabbed the small truck hadn't bothered calling anyone on his walkie-talkie. He'd just hopped in and rolled out. Finnegan took that as a good sign. He pulled himself out of the lube oil filter pit. The soldier had veered toward the back of the shop, and Finnegan headed that way now, finding what he'd missed first, a pegboard with keys. He grabbed the one that matched the Scania with the Ragusa Logistics logo. He dashed to the big door and hit the red button. The door began to rise. He climbed into the truck, turned over the ignition, and saw the fuel gauge bob over to full. He rolled out of the garage without a care in the world. New York boys don't know the ins and outs of human trafficking and white slavery, but stealing a car? Bitch, please. He tooled up to the row of barracks. A guard had been posted at Barracks 3, but now wasn't. Fiero and the guys were inside. He let the truck roll to a halt with only a light tap of the brakes, no way of knowing how squeaky the brake pads were on this big boy. He halted beside Barracks 3. The door didn't open. Fiero grabbed Mohammed by both shoulders. He looked like he was a breath away from having a heart attack.
"It's all right. He didn't mean to. You're okay."
The kid looked around at the wakeful refugee children and the strange soldiers. He peered at two of the bunks, empty except for a backpack.
"Where's Amira?"
"Amira?" If anything, the boy's eyes grew wider. "Where's Amira? Where's my sister?" Fiero cursed herself. She'd sacrificed 3 of the refugees to separate the enemy. The sister likely was among them.
"Listen, the soldiers took 3 of the children. Are you listening to me?"
The boy nodded. She could see him working to master his fear, even though his body was rigid with it. Impressive kid.
We know where they're going, okay? We'll get you all out of here. We'll catch up to them, okay?
The boy gulped, but then nodded once more.
We are from Homs, Amira and me. We do not know where our parents are. They were with us, but...
He shrugged.
We are traveling with a British girl.
Fierro frowned.
British?
Mohammed said.
Woman. British woman, Jinan. She is very brave. She is gone, too. I think she is protecting Amira. I went to find food. I left them.
You did good,
Fierro said, and gripped his shoulders tighter.
Do you hear me? You did good.
Mohammed raised one skinny arm and pointed at Bianchi.
That man tried to shoot me.
That's because he's not a very good soldier, but the big man with the beard is.
He's your leader?
I'm his leader, Fierro said.
We're going to get everyone out. Are you ready to help me?
Finnegan drummed on the steering wheel. He checked his watch. He heard the squeak of a door hinge well off to his left. A Kosovar soldier stepped out of the admin building, an unlit cigarette to his lips, lighter halfway there. He saw the idling truck. Finnegan casually reached down and wrapped his hand around the grip of his 9mm. The soldier threw the cigarette into the dirt and marched his way. He swung a carbine off his shoulder, the gun rotating like the pendulum of a clock. He made it another 3 steps and shuddered, went to one knee and landed on his chest. He made no effort to block his fall, his cheek flopping into the dirt. In his earpiece, Finnegan heard the Ethiopian in the guard tower.
"Bravo down, inner courtyard,"
Fierro's voice answered. "Copy that, coming out." The barracks door opened and McTavish led the way. He popped open the canopy in the back of the truck. Fierro came next, escorting very young and very frightened children. 2 by 2, McTavish and Fierro helped them into the truck, the teenagers in turn helping the younger ones get settled. They just kept coming, 2 by 2 by 2. Everyone remained quiet. Fierro touched her ear jack.
"Stryker, give us 30, then evac."
Fecado said,
"Roger."
Bianchi emerged from the barracks last, gun to his shoulder, leading with it, checking left and right and rotating gracefully on his lead foot. Someone, somewhere, shouted. The voice was Slavic and a little panicky. Finnegan couldn't tell where it came from.
"Muslim and Deka, oni!"
The voice stopped abruptly. Fecado said,
"Second Bravo down. He came from the perimeter fence. Lights coming on in the admin building."
Fierro climbed into the passenger seat next to Finnegan and spoke into her mic.
"Stryker, evac now."
She turned to Finnegan. "Go!" More men were yelling. More windows lit up. Fierro rolled down her window. McTavish popped one of the stays on the side of the truck, creating an aperture under the tarp on the driver's side. Bianchi took up position at the rear. The windshield directly in front of Finnegan's face cracked in a starburst pattern. He instinctively ducked but kept driving, upshifting from first to second. Fierro said,
"You drive like my grandmother,"
Finnegan grunted and hauled on the wheel.
"My mother's mother," she amended. "You know, the one who's been dead for 5 years."
McTavish fired a single shot to the left. Bianchi let loose a rapid blast on full auto, straight back. Finnegan vectored for the gate. The red and white striped barrier arm remained down. A bullet pinged off the doorframe, inches from his shoulder. McTavish responded on full auto. They curved around the communications building and Finnegan jammed on the brakes. The kid screamed in horror. Lo Kwan dashed from the building and, with Bianchi's help, hurtled onto the tailgate and landed in the back. Fierro said,
"Got him!"
Soldiers came running around the building, firing. Finnegan gunned the engine. The cell tower atop the communications building exploded, the shock flash of light sending monster shadows throughout the courtyard. The coming soldiers ducked, throwing arms up over their heads, fearing an aerial assault. The cell tower began collapsing, one leg disintegrated. Fierro had asked for deaf and blind, please. Lo Kwan had delivered. The truck's RPMs climbed near the red zone as Finnegan smashed the Scania through the blocker arm at the gate. Fierro, McTavish, and Bianchi laid down suppression fire as the truck roared into the night. Fierro turned to Finnegan and nodded. She touched her ear jack.
"Stryker?"
Fecado sounded out of breath. "I've reached our truck, rendezvous on the highway."
"Well done," she said, and turned to say something reassuring to one of the Muslim boys behind her.
The kid appeared to be about 15 and was the least panicked of the refugees. He and Fierro spoke in Arabic. Then the boy turned and spoke to the other children. They began to calm down. Fierro sat forward in her seat.
"Nice driving. How many did we get?"
She did a quick head count. 16 and 3 to go.
Sorry?
She had removed her rucksack and thrust it into the space between her long legs. She withdrew their sat phone and tapped in the unlock code.
3 others were taken. My young assistant here is Mohammed. His sister and an English girl are among the missing. They'll be heading to Belgrade.
Finnegan blinked at the road through the star-shaped crack in the windshield.
English?
Fierro shrugged.
We were heading to Belgrade anyway, he said. Guess we just have to get there faster. I'm calling Shan now.
Finnegan drove. Behind them, they could hear Mohammed calming the other children. Now that they were on the highway, McTavish and Bianchi stowed their weapons out of sight. With a single honk, the stolen laundry truck from Sarajevo pulled up next to them. Ficado waved from behind the wheel, then fell back and tucked in behind the Scania. Throughout, Fierro kept the sat phone to her ear. A kilometer passed under their wheels. She made eye contact with Finnegan.
No Shan?
She shook her head.
That's a complication. He was going to get a world court envoy to get us across the border.
A sign drew closer, in both English and Cyrillic. It announced 15 kilometers to the Serbian border. Chapter 50. Serbian Border. The smaller Ragusa Logistics truck pulled up to the border crossing and picked the northernmost gatehouse, the one designated for military vehicles, police, and other first responders. Lieutenant Krasnici climbed into the back and drew his Glock sidearm. He showed it to Jane, Amira, and the Afghan boy.
Shh!
They sat huddled together, their eyes on the slow boil smile of the lieutenant. Jane's headache had dropped to tolerable levels. She noticed for the first time that her backpack was missing, and with it, her British identification and her passport. She wasn't sure if that was a good thing or a bad thing. It was going on 3 a.m., and a Kosovar border guard jogged slowly out of the office toward the gate. He recognized the Ragusa Logistics logo. He circled around to the driver's side, where the private handed him an envelope of euros. "Have a pleasant journey," he laughed, and unlocked the gatehouse, hitting the switch and raising the barrier. The truck rolled into Serbia. 100 yards ahead lay identical gates and gatehouses staffed by Serbian soldiers. The private reached for the second envelope of euros. He'd made the trip enough times to separate the money for the matching guards on both the Kosovar and Serbian sides before arriving. Lieutenant Krasnici waited until they were past the second barrier and picking up speed. He reholstered his weapon and shouldered his way through the hatch back to the cab. Jane squeezed Amira's shoulder very tight. The girl trembled.
"I want Mohammed. Where's Mohammed?"
"I know, love." She let her fingertips trace the pulpy edge of the girl's forearm cast.
"Amira, do you still have the phone I gave you?"
They were wasting time, and everyone on the team knew it. The stolen Ragusa truck and the Bosnian laundry truck puffed into a broken-down warehouse. Bianchi got out and cut through a chain to open the gate, and the trucks rumbled over pitted tarmac that had broken up into large chunks, like a melting ice cap, between seas of reedy grass. Fierro and Ficado, who spoke Arabic, assured the children that the stop was necessary, and Ficado escorted the children, two by two and by gender, to a locked and darkened water closet to relieve themselves by the glow of flashlights. Nobody could help the Afghan children to understand, but Mohammed Bakur took it upon himself to keep them calm. The St. Nicholas partners gathered with McTavish's mercenaries around the hood of the laundry truck to go over the situation. Finnegan said,
"Our contact was supposed to have clerks of the International Criminal Court and UN observers at the Serbian border. They were to take the kids and get them safe. But also get them on camera, start building a case against the guys running the shit show."
"No contact?" McTavish fussed with his massive beard. The partners shook their heads.
"We have to assume the worst," Finnegan said. "Our contact is compromised, and we're working illegally in Kosovo without a lifeline. The border is off limits, at least as far as these kids are concerned."
McTavish made a sword of his hand and thrust it westward.
"Then we got them out the way we got in, overland into Bosnia, into Sarajevo."
Finnegan considered the plan. Taking out the cell tower and the radio tower at the base only bought us so much time. "We can get these 16 kids out the way you say, but not the 3 who left in the first truck. So we split up. McTavish and the guys get these kids to Sarajevo, get them to the U.S. Embassy there. We'll go after the others in Belgrade."
"And Lazar Aleksic," Fierro added.
"Most definitely." It was agreed. Ficado would switch to the big truck with Lo Kuan driving. They'd reverse course and take the goat trails back over the hills just as they'd entered. But it was already going on 0400 hours, and they wanted to get across before the sun rose. Time wasn't their friend. Muhammad was bringing the final group of Afghan boys back from the bathroom. Fierro nodded him over and explained the plan.
"Your job is to keep the youths calm on the drive to Sarajevo," she said,
and he replied simply,
"I'm coming with you. You can't. I need you to. I'm coming with you."
She looked him sternly in the eye.
"Muhammad, you have to be the man now. I need you."
"No." He didn't sound scared or angry, only resolute. He maintained eye contact and his emotions.
"My father and mother might be in Turkey or Greece. I don't know, and they do not know where we are. My sister is in the hands of monsters. I am the only family left who can save Amira. And when we reach her, I'm the one she'll listen to and believe. You'll just be more Westerners with more guns."
Fierro opened her mouth to counter, and Muhammad didn't wait.
"You need me to be a man? In my family right now, I am the man."
Finnegan circled the laundry truck, but kept his distance. He pretended to watch the stars. Fierro rose and turned to him.
"He's coming with us."
Chapter 51. Belgrade. The smaller Ragusa Logistics truck carrying the kidnapped Muslims joined the E-75 heading north, making great time in the pre-dawn hours, and rolled into the city, turning off the freeway virtually within sight of the great Eastern Orthodox Temple of St. Sava. The morning traffic was still light, with only service trucks and a few cars on the streets. Lieutenant Krasnichi allowed himself to drift to sleep intermittently, secure in the knowledge that the three urchins in back wouldn't make any trouble. The soldiers had made this run often enough that they had become inured to the danger. As they left the freeway and vectored onto the main street of Kneza Milosha, he drew his prepaid cell phone and called the Ragusa building to alert them. "The garage will be open as you roll up, sir," the graveyard shift soldier told him. "Put coffee on. Is the major there?" "Negative, sir. He flew north to the Netherlands." That was odd. Krasnichi wondered why. Blue lights began flickering in the rearview mirror. The soldiers glanced back and saw a Belgrade police officer on a motorbike urging them to pull over. Krasnichi said, "Hold. We'll get there shortly," and hung up. They pulled over just shy of Embassy Row. Belgrade was safe territory for the Kosovars, but being this close to so many international diplomats still seemed risky. The motorcycle officer doffed his helmet and approached on the passenger side, which was unusual for a traffic stop. Krasnichi rolled down his window. "Help you?" The traffic cop looked more than a little ill, even under the harsh early morning streetlights. "I need you to stay here, sir." "You really don't. We're fully permitted." The kid, he was all of 23, Krasnichi thought, wet his lips. "I'm sorry, sir. I just got orders to detain your vehicle. Please stay inside the vehicle. Please turn off the engine and remain here." Krasnichi smiled benevolently. "Do you know Inspector Marko Petrovich? In your major crimes division, check with him. He'll see you done right." Krasnichi was confident. The inspector's palm had been well greased for exactly this reason. The traffic cop said, "I am under orders from Inspector Petrovich. Please remain in your vehicle." He walked back to his motorcycle. The corporal looked at his lieutenant, then cast a glance back toward the rear of the truck. It was a hell of a cargo to sit with, this close to the embassies of the world. Jane could hear the police officer speaking outside the truck, but the words were muffled, and she didn't speak the language. She knew they were in a major city because the ambient urban noises had become evident over the past several minutes. She wasn't even sure the man speaking outside the truck was a cop, but she suspected he was. Thanks to the phone call she'd made with the last of the charge left in the mobile hidden in Amira's arm cast. Chapter 52. Bodujevo, Kosovo. A French long-haul truck driver pulled into a rest stop just shy of the Serbian border. He would have liked to have made it through before dawn, but the demands of his bladder were not to be denied. He relieved himself and stepped out of the bathroom and found a woman leaning against the cinder block with only her shoulder blades and the sole of one boot touching the rough wall. She was at least 5'10", with pitch-black hair worn down. She was dressed in black canvas trousers with many pockets, like a soldier, and a black tea-backed undershirt.
"I need a lift into Serbia," she said, picking French. The truck driver didn't know how she'd tumbled onto his nationality. He humphed.
"Well, I need 500 euros and a blowjob,"
she said. "Done," and disconnected herself from the wall by shoving with her foot. She produced a wad of euros and stuffed them into his hand.
"Shall we?"
He led her around to the parking area, a bit after 5 in the morning, and it was mostly empty. As they drew abreast of his big, Russian-made truck and trailer rig, he spotted a gangly boy in ripped jeans and a grimy hooded sweatshirt. Also a wiry man with messy hair and several days' growth of beard. He, too, wore fatigue pants, boots, and a black T-shirt. He grinned in the manner of congenital idiots and Americans. The trucker said,
"What's this?"
"My lover," the tall woman gestured to the smiling man. "We're running away to Belgrade. Papa doesn't like him."
"Your papa may be onto something there."
"Would another 500 euros help?"
She handed him another wad of money, then reached up for the passenger side handle and climbed up on the wheel covering. She turned to the smiling man.
"Oh, darling, our driver would like a blowjob. Do you mind?"
The trucker sighed wearily.
"Comédienne."
The St. Nicholas team and Mohammed sat in back, cross-legged among boxes of auto parts. They'd shown the French driver more stacks of euros and felt confident he'd get them across the border. Mohammed closed his eyes. It was a wonder he'd stayed awake, given the past week of his life. Finnegan, speaking English, nonetheless kept his voice low.
"We're too late." "I know."
Blowing the comms tower delayed them calling out for help, but as soon as a single one of them drives into range of the next cell tower, they'll call Alexich and he'll have the kids killed, including you-know-whose sister. Fierro knew her partner liked to think out loud to sort the facts in his own head, so she let him prattle on. "If they had a sat phone at the base, they wouldn't even need to get to a cell tower." She nodded. The truck hit a bump, and Muhammad's eyes shot open, glaring around. "Fight or flight." Finnegan offered him a stick of gum and an easy smile. They rode in silence. Muhammad's eyes dropped again, and he rested his head on one of the boxes. Finnegan said, "Mission one is to rescue the kids. Mission two is to get the evidence for a conviction." Fierro closed her eyes and also rested her head back on the box. "We are not going to Belgrade to assassinate Lazar Alexich," Finnegan spoke softly. Fierro nodded to the youth half asleep next to them.
"Tell him that."
"Okay." Finnegan leaned forward and tapped the kid on the knee. Mohammed raised his head and opened his eyes.
"Translate for me,"
Fierro said.
"This isn't, please."
She hesitated, then nodded. "Mohammed, I'm Michael. This is Catalan." Fierro translated. "I'm a police officer. Catalan is a soldier. The good kind, not like the guys who kidnapped you." The boy listened to the near instantaneous translation and nodded.
"Can you save Amira and Jinan?"
Fierro repeated the question in English. Finnegan kept his eyes locked on the kid.
"Maybe. I'm not going to lie to you. It won't be easy. We'll try as hard as we can. If we don't, we'll arrest the men responsible and we'll make sure they go to prison."
He was speaking to the boy for sure, but also to his partner. Mohammed frowned.
"If these people hurt my sister, I want them to die."
"Yeah, I get that, sure. But I'm a policeman and Catalan is a soldier," he repeated.
"We can mete out justice, not vengeance. Only God can do that. And God would want us to do our best and to be true to our calling. You understand?"
Mohammed spoke. After a moment, Fierro said,
"Yes, I understand, but I don't like it."
And Finnegan knew she wasn't just translating.
"I know,"
he said. "To them both." Chapter 53. Belgrade. Inspector Marko Petrovic of the Belgrade Police Department's Special Crimes Division believed that the worst ways to wake up were A, with a gun pointed at you, B, with your wife in some other man's bed, and C, with calls from the media. Possibly he'd switch B and C. It was close. He'd received word from his night watch commanders that the Irish Times had called, saying one of their freelance journalists had uncovered a plot by Kosovar soldiers to sell underage refugees on the slave market in Belgrade. Worse, the reporter was actually with some of the victims and some of the smugglers and reporting in real time from the Serbian capital. After the Times called, Reuters called, then Al Jazeera, then Sky News, then the BBC. The time between each call was diminishing, so that they essentially were tying up every phone line on the night shift of police headquarters. Petrovich told his officers to stall and lie. He wasn't exactly the Napoleon of media strategies. It was the best option he could come up with at 5 in the morning. He dressed and put on his coat and waddled out to the backyard, digging through his pile of firewood for a sealed sandwich bag and a disposable mobile phone that he wanted his wife never to find. He called his contact at Ragusa Logistics in the mostly finished office building on Kneza Miloša. He got some wet behind the ears junior officer who was under orders to work with Petrovich whenever he called. After all, Petrovich kept all of the cops away from Lazar Aleksic and had since the kid arrived on the scene a few years earlier.
"Do you have a truck coming in from Kosovo?" he demanded.
Yes, sir.
"For the love of Jesus, do you know how much shit is hitting the fan right this second?" the youth said.
No, sir, no, I...
"Shit, sir?" "By Joseph and Blessed Mary, get the truck to your building. Do it now. I'm on my way. Who's in charge there?"
"Lieutenant Krasnichi, sir."
"Have him meet me there. And, son?"
"Sir."
"Tell your lieutenant that if he's ever felt a shortage of assholes, not to worry. He's about to get himself a brand new one."
The French trucker dropped the partners and Mohammed off at an auto grill on the Serbian side, took his money, and resumed his route. Finnegan spied a couple of guys dressed as highway construction workers park a Jeep Wrangler near the children's play structure and head into the restaurant.
"That looks juicy."
"I'll explain to Mohammed that the nice police officer likes to steal cars."
Finnegan waggled his finger at Mohammed but spoke to Fierro.
"Steal a car for a man, and he'll drive for a day. But teach a man to steal a car, and he'll drive for life."
They drove the Wrangler into Belgrade just as their watches hit 6 a.m. Mohammed eyed the big city with fear in his eyes.
"We have to find Amira in this?"
"We know where she is," Fierro told him, and turned to Finnegan. "Remember our friend Egon Yumnica from France? I found him at the barracks with the refugees."
"Poor dumb bastard," Finnegan said.
"We had a heart-to-heart. He says to say hi." She smiled. "He said the front doors of the office tower are chained, and the only access is through the parking garage. The elevators are controlled by soldiers on the penthouse level."
Finnegan nodded. They both knew that the lieutenant and his three hostages had at least an hour head start on them by now. The chances of getting to the hostages in time, in that tower, were diminishing quickly. He pulled the Jeep off the highway and headed toward the office tower, Fierro riding shotgun and Mohammed in back.
"Slowly," she said. "I want to see how many guards they—"
"Amira!"
Mohammed almost ripped open the rear door and leaped out of the moving vehicle. Fierro restrained him. A BMW X5 sat outside the Ragusa Logistics building with police flashers embedded in the grill, the engine running. Three men stood around the vehicle. Two who looked like soldiers were being yelled at by an obese civilian with a magnificent mustache. In the back of the SUV, three young people sat shoulder to shoulder, a boy and two girls.
"It's Amira and Jane. You found them,"
Finnegan said, "shh," and kept rolling. Fierro watched the scene as they drove past. The big man with the medicine ball belly had a finger in the face of the lead soldier, chewing him out. The three Middle Eastern youths sat in the back of the SUV, looking petrified. A few pedestrians out at that hour were giving the melee a wide berth.
"How the hell did we make up so much time?" Finnegan wondered, hitting his turn indicator and drifting to his left. "No idea, but gift horses."
So Aleksic has bent cops. That was predictable. He pulled into an alley perpendicular with the main drag. He knew this alley well. He'd taken a baseball bat to two soldiers here not long ago.
"We'll have to go back," Mohammed wailed. "We will," Fierro calmed him. "Mohammed, we have to do this smart, yes? Those men have guns, and they have your sister."
The boy was all but bouncing in his seat. Finnegan took the next left, routing them back in the direction they'd come. The next alley over would dump out onto Kneza Miloša again. Finnegan said,
"Translate, will you?"
He took the next left and slowed to a halt.
"Kid, climb out here. Run up to that corner, okay?
There could be more bad guys, and I need you to alert us if you see them. Here. He drew his cell and held it over his shoulder. Muhammad reached for it. Speed dial number 1 is Catalan. You know how to use it?
Of course, he told the woman translating.
Good. Go. He climbed out and dashed, all knees and elbows, toward the street ahead of him. Good kid, Finnegan said, and threw the jeep into gear. They slow-rolled forward.
The garage door's closed, Fierro said.
They gotta get the kids inside.
Last time we passed by here, we saw a ramp leading to the basement.
Fierro smiled.
Gravity's our friend.
Roll cages on those BMWs are sweet.
Shall we?
Fierro reached for her door handle and climbed out of the car. Finnegan adjusted his seatbelt. Chapter 54. Lieutenant Akhil Krasnichi stood his ground, unwilling to capitulate to the crooked head of the Belgrade Police Department's Major Crimes Unit.
I understand, sir, but half of the fucking journalists on Earth are screeching at us for answers, Lieutenant. The New York Times, the London Times, the Washington Post. The man vibrated, his jowls and belly shaking. The fucking Montreal fucking Gazette. All because you idiots captured a fucking journalist.
Inspector Petrovich pointed a nicotine-yellowed finger back at his BMW X5 and the three heads barely visible behind the seatbacks.
Get rid of them, Lieutenant. Don't do it in Belgrade, and don't do it in Serbia. Take your mongrels back to Kosovo and cook them for all I care. Then tell Major Basha that our deal is being renegotiated. Am I making myself clear, Lieutenant?
Krasnichi saw no advantage in continuing the argument, here on the pavement, with the sun rising and the traffic picking up. He had every intention of contacting Major Basha as soon as he could get this confrontation inside the building and off the street. Krasnichi had heard from KSF operating Bashar, of course. He knew that armed insurgents had stolen his other 16 refugees, according to Capral Agon Yumnica. The insurgents represented another army unit that wanted in on the profits. That meant any deal cut with the Belgrade police was now suspect. It was time, the lieutenant thought, for their forces to regroup and reconsider their options. That meant killing everyone currently connected to their operation. The stolen kids, the crooked cops, even Lazar Aleksic.
Take them into the garage, he told the inspector, avoiding the use of sir or the man's title. We'll transfer them to our vehicle. He drew his walkie-talkie. Open the door.
The garage door began rolling upward on well-oiled tracks. Inspector Petrovich marched around to the passenger side of the BMW and damn near sprang the door hinges before climbing in, the shocks wobbling under his girth. He growled at his driver.
Get them inside.
The driver checked to see that the garage door was sufficiently high, then put the car into gear. He turned 90 degrees, the front tires reaching the lip of the ramp. The BMW's nose dipped. Finnegan swerved the stolen Wrangler out of the morning traffic on Kneza Milosha and slammed it to the rear of the Beamer. Petrovich, the driver, Jane Houri, Amira, and the Afghan boy, everyone's head snapped back. Finnegan gunned it, and the two cars began rolling down the concrete ramp. Petrovich's driver screamed and stomped on the brakes. The BMW began to glide sideways relative to the ramp. Finnegan tapped his own brakes, creating a little air between them. As the left side of the BMW came around, he punched it again, slamming back into the car, which now screeched sideways down the ramp, tires belching blue smoke. Finnegan saw the driver and the children in back screaming in shock. The BMW, now acting like a snowplow in front of the jeep, rumbled downhill, tires bursting, rims screeching, and slammed sideways into a support pillar. Up top, Lieutenant Krasnichi and his corporal stood on the sidewalk, gawking, shocked. Neither even noticed as Fierro strolled up the sidewalk toward them. Krasnichi drew his gun and began moving downhill. As she drew abreast of the corporal, Fierro swung her elbow and clocked him in the temple. The man's eyes rolled up in his skull. Before he could fall, she grabbed him by the lapels and hip-checked him down the ramp. His body bowled into the back of Krasnichi's heels like they were 10 pins. The lieutenant had been picking up speed and was off balance to begin with. He stumbled, falling, trying to arrest his impact by letting go of his sidearm. But he was too late, and his wrist broke badly as he hit the concrete. In the jeep, Finnegan coughed talcum and shoved away the deflated airbag. Having rolled down all the windows prior to hitting the SUV, he undid his seatbelt and climbed out through his window, sliding onto the crumpled hood of the jeep and bracing his boots on either side of the busted-out driver's window. He reached through between his own legs and hauled out the police driver. The man's head lolled. Finnegan clocked him once, just to be sure, and dumped him over the side of the jeep's hood. The man slid over the edge, but one foot got tangled in his seatbelt, and he hung off the side like a landed fish. The fat man with a walrus mustache leaned forward, blood pouring out of his nose, his eyes closed. In back, the children looked petrified, but largely unhurt. The BMW is a marvel of safety, Finnegan thought. He glanced back and saw Fierro march down the ramp, stepping over two unconscious soldiers. He looked around. The garage could hold 100 cars, maybe, but today housed only a handful of hot, expensive, and pristinely washed cars, including a Jag and a gold Hummer. Somebody once said that crime doesn't pay. Finnegan thought that person was full of shit. Fierro reached the bottom of the ramp and drew her SIG. A soldier came running from the direction of the elevators, and she shot him once in the chest. The man stumbled, falling forward. He wore body armor, but a 45 is a 45, and the hydrostatic shock of the hit likely broke some ribs. She looked back the way they'd come. No pedestrians had stopped. Traffic on Knez Milosha continued as if nothing had happened. A moment later, Muhammad's expressive face appeared at the garage door. Fierro whistled and signaled him down. She turned and marched over the guy she'd shot, stopping long enough to clock him behind the ear with the butt of her gun. She rose and headed to the 3-car elevator bank. She found the controls for the garage door and hit down. Muhammad, still near the top of the ramp, stood with his eyes and mouth forming an almost perfect circle. Finnegan could guess what he was thinking. Muslim women in Europe aren't what I expected. But then the sight of Amira climbing out of the BMW caught the boy's eyes, and he sprinted downhill. Jane Houri climbed out as well as she could with her wrists cuffed behind her back. So did the Afghan boy who'd been taken with them. Finnegan retrieved a handcuff key from the cop he'd KO'd and got the 3 refugees freed. Muhammad, Amira, and Jane hugged and wept. There was much crying in rapid-fire Arabic, so Finnegan backed off the scrum. Fierro came his way. Elevators locked out, as we were told. Finnegan jutted his chin at the lieutenant, halfway up the ramp, who held his broken wrist and rocked onto his back, moaning. Think he'll help?
We can ask nice.
Jane broke free of the group hugs and came to them. Tears streamed down her grubby face, and her hair was askew. She spoke English.
Excuse me, please. Who are you?
Finnegan produced a packet of Kleenex from his cargo pocket and handed it to her.
St. Nicholas Salvage and Wrecking.
She blew her nose.
I don't even know what that means. I'm Jane Houri. I'm a reporter for... I'm an independent reporter. You're Americans,
Fierro said.
He is,
and headed uphill toward Lieutenant Krasnichi.
I can't thank you enough. These kids, they're my responsibility. I was trying to get them to safety.
She started crying again.
And you did, kiddo. Give us a bump.
Finnegan put his fist out, knuckles forward. She burst into a hybrid sob laugh and reached up to tap her knuckles against his. She produced a cheap flip phone.
I called my editor at the Irish Times. I told them where we were, what was happening. I think that's why the police got involved here.
We were wondering who bought us the time to catch up.
Catch up?
We were at the base in Kosovo. We got the other 16 kids out. Jane started crying into the wad of Kleenex again. Finnegan grinned at her.
You are one badass reporter, Jane Houri.